You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
And happy Tuesday to you. Christina Long in studio with me. Arkansas get a little bit closer every day to the start of the football season. August 29th season opener against UAPB, 16 days away now down at War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock. Razorbacks continue to go through practice. This morning, a couple of notes, notable returns, I guess, for the Razorbacks in practice is you had Luke Haz, who had been out in concussion protocol, back, you know, fully, you know, full go, basically, for the Razorbacks. Also, Anton Junkaj, who had also been in concussion protocol, the defensive end, he was back from that concussion as well. So, Christine, I guess the good news for the Razorbacks is that they're getting a lot of their players back. We saw Andrew Armstrong and Tyrone Broden. They've been back. Kind of, you know, coming to fruition what Sam Pittman said last week, that none of these injuries are expected to be real long-term. And you know, I would contend that you need these guys in practice, you know, especially because some of them hadn't gone through a whole lot of fully padded practices to just get ready for the season.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think even though we were told last week by Sam Pittman that these injuries weren't expected to be major long-term, you know, nobody was going to be done for the season. It was still, you know, there's always concern with injuries. There's, you don't, especially when you don't know what they are, which, you know, we understand why they don't always share all of that, but you don't know if it's something that might come back or if it is, you know, a concussion where there's a standard protocol and there's a set window of when they're going to be back. And so seeing some of these guys come back has been good. Still no Patrick Kudus on the offensive line. He's dealing with a back issue, Coach Pittman said. So that's still a concern, and they've been doing a lot of shuffling. It gives them the opportunity to experiment on the line and see what they have depth-wise and what options they have because, you know, it's a long season. Offensive line is a grind, and, you know, you're going to lose some people. You're going to have some people in and out. So that's allowed them to do that, and they've gotten some other guys back. You know, Marquise Robinson was back after a concussion. You know, some different people like that.
I want to talk more about offensive line here in just a minute. You were in the room the other day when Sam was talking. I asked him the question about injury reports because there was a CBS story that was it came out last week, and they said that the SEC is nearing a basically kind of uniform policy to have injury reports that would be similar to what you have in the NFL. In the NFL, you get to a certain day. I'm not sure what it is. I think it may be 2 days before the game is played, and you've got to designate, hey, he's doubtful, he's questionable, he's out. I don't know that you've got to say exactly what the injury is, but you do have to at least kind of give an idea of what's going on with these or what's going on with different players who have been injured. And, you know, what I fully expect is that college coaches will manipulate this and just say questionable, 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 you know, doubtful maybe on on somebody who's been out. But he is in favor of this. It seems like that train's about to leave the station. You know, LSU and Florida, they did this last year. I think the Big Ten has a mandatory injury reporting policy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, one of the biggest pains, at least for what we do, is trying to figure out who's going to be playing and not playing. And, you know, there's a little bit of gamesmanship about not wanting your opponent to know who's playing, whatever. And like you said, that might continue. I think the NFL... I had read somewhere, I'm not a big NFL fan, but I read somewhere that with the NFL's policies, they can, there is a fine structure for if you, basically if you lie, you know, if they go and look and find that somebody else or that you knew that they were going to play and you said they weren't or vice versa, you know. And so I don't know if that's on the table for college football. I don't know what the Big Ten structure is like. So that would be one thing that they could do to maybe prevent that. What with questionable, it's so vague that how are you going to know if someone was questionable or not? I mean, in theory, it's always questionable.
I guess everybody's questionable.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I don't know how that would look. But as far as, you know, one thing Pittman said was he was like, I like it because out is just out. I don't have to say why. You can ask me, but I don't have to tell you. I just have to tell you that he's out. Because, and he pointed out, you know, sometimes it's disciplinary. Sometimes it's a family member has died, you know, and that might not be something that they want to disclose. And so if all you have to do is put next to his name that he's out, Pittman likes that. He likes that it you can answer the question without having to give lots of details if you don't want to.
Didn't the Bengals, I think they got fined pretty hefty a year or two ago because Joe Burrow showed up to a game with a kind of a cast around his thumb, and there was no mention of this beforehand. And it was like this real grainy,
I do remember that,
almost like a Zapruder-like video. of his thumb, and that's what ended up kind of piquing people's curiosity. Right. I think it had been posted on social media or something, and that's what, you know, piqued the curiosity about, hey, is something going on here with him? So it's hard to enforce, and I have a hard time. I don't know. I have a hard time believing the SEC is going to levy fines on the schools very much. It seems like they're pretty...
Especially out of the gate, like when they institute the policy. I can't imagine that. I guess I just don't think it's like... I don't think it's that serious. I don't think it's that big of a thing. Unless it becomes a problem with... Because a big reason they want to do it is because of the sports gambling aspect. Mm-hmm. To prevent players from getting, you know, harassed for information and things like that. Or people, you know, analyzing, you know, grainy photos of people's thumbs. And so... They want to protect the college kids from that. And so I think that's a big part of it. And so if there was a thing where the system was kind of being manipulated and it was not solving the problem that it set out to solve, then maybe they would do something. But yeah, I don't think out of the gate we'll see some kind of strict rule around that.
You know, Pittman, he says that you're going to know who's out anyway. I mean, any reporter worth their salt is sitting there an hour and a half before the game begins with a pair of binoculars and a depth chart, you know, basically checking off, hey, he's here, he's here, he's here. And then, you know, you kind of figure out, well, hey, the fullback is missing. I guess there's no fullbacks anymore that may show my age. But, you know, the tight end is missing, the safety is missing, and you may or may not get an explanation before the game about why they're missing. So I like this. It's coming in, you know, it's people don't like making college football like the NFL. The NFL is not a bad product. I mean, it's a very good product. It's a product worth billions and billions of dollars a year. And so I think that if there are ways, I think there are ways to take college football and make it more like the NFL without making it the NFL, if that makes any sense. Make, you know, if there are things that the NFL do that are positive, then, you know, take steps forward and do things like that while still trying to maintain as much about the college game that people love as possible. And that's getting harder and harder to do.
Right. And that's what I worry about. I think the, and this gets into some conference realignment talk that we maybe don't want to go all the way into because that's a whole, you know, subject. But I think the big thing to me with college sports has some, a big part of the magic of it has been kind of the regionality and the regional identity that comes with college football and, you know, some of the rivalry stuff. And, you know, the NFL has rivalry. Obviously the NFL is associated with cities, people in those cities, in those states, they rally around the team. That is what sports are. But I just think that college football has a particular, because you have so many teams and you have, you know, states sharing teams, things like that, you know, and I just think that the regional aspect is part of, brings a lot of the sort of charm and magic that the NFL doesn't always have or that does differently. And I think that's one of the things that makes it a college football unique product from the NFL. And I do worry about losing that. I think we already see it some of the realignment stuff. And I'm not necessarily opposed to, you know, some of the new matchups that we're seeing and some of the things that might become, I mean, this is kind of an oxymoron, but a new rivalry. So I just think that that's something that they need to try to preserve as we kind of go into this next iteration. Maybe I, you know, maybe college football is headed for a more of an NFL model where there's, you know, an AFC and an NFC, you know, and like, and there's kind of two different large leagues that are competing against each other or whatever. Maybe we end up seeing that and people like to throw around Super League. Maybe we see that. But if you could just preserve, even if you have that, even if you have two massive leagues, two massive conferences, if you could just preserve within those some of that, you know, regionality, rivalry, you know, things like that, that would be okay with me.
I don't know how easy that's going to be.
I know.
Anymore.
That's the thing.
Think about the Big Ten, and we're going to get into this a little bit later because the AP Top 25 football poll came out yesterday, and I've got some thoughts on schedule strength and how travel plays into that, and we'll get that in a minute. But, you know, you get the Big Ten. Yep, teams making transcontinental flights. There's nothing regional about that. And it's one thing to be doing that in football. I really feel for the players in sports like basketball and volleyball and, you know, the ones that play in the midweek and then they're expected to get on a red eye and get back home and maybe be in class by the next afternoon. It just seems like that's an awfully, it's a hard ask. I don't know how we got down that rabbit hole, but
I brought up conference realignment. I knew it was going to be a whole thing.
let's circle back to this football team. We mentioned offensive line. Yeah, I was thinking about something this morning. there are players on this offensive line who have been part of the program for a few years now. And, you know, used to, what would happen was you would a lot of times you wouldn't play on the offensive line until your second, third, maybe even fourth year. I remember I've heard a story before about, you know, Tom Osborne would bring in, you know, reporters during the preseason, and he would talk, yeah, you know, you've never heard of, you know, this guy, but he's going to be an All-American this year because he's been in the program for 3 or 4 years, and now it's his time to cycle into being a starter. You know, I don't think Nebraska, typically their offensive linemen would ever start for more than a couple of years, and it was just because the expectation was you'd come in, you'd get a redshirt season, then you'd get, you know, a year or two of development, and, you know, it's that's what would happen. And now all of a sudden, you know, obviously everybody expects to play right away, and if you don't, you're going to take the first, you know, flight out of town. But where I was going with this, Arkansas does have a few offensive linemen on this team. Patrick Kutis, who we saw last year, the expectation is that if he's healthy, he's going to be a really good guard for them. I don't know if really good is the right word, but he's going to be a productive guard for them. Sam Pittman said a lot of times throughout the preseason that they thought, you know, he played tackle out of necessity last year, but they think that he's going to be better inside. And they think that, you know, he'll be good once he is healthy and can make that move. Obviously, he hasn't been in practice in a while, and I think there's got to be some concern there about that, the fact that he's only practiced maybe one or two times so far this preseason. Marion Harris has gotten some rotation with Kutis out and at guard. You got Tykes Crawford, who's been in the program for a few years now. And you just wonder about these players like Harris and Crawford. You know, at what point do they fulfill their potential? And is this the year that maybe they can do that? I don't know what the answer is to that, but it's just interesting to me that you've got a couple of older offensive linemen, a few older offensive linemen who have been in the program for a few years. There's more, obviously, you know, like Carmona and Blackstock, they've transferred in, you know, but when do these guys launch, so right. to speak?
And it's hard when you have, and I'm not, you know, an anti-transfer person, but I think it is hard when you have those guys that have been going through the development within the program, and then you have guys transfer in who, and then kind of get automatically slotted into some of those starting spots. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's been what's hard for Tykes Crawford. I mean, I feel like every year we hear that Tykes Crawford is right there. Yeah. He's right next to, you know, he's pushing for the start, and he's got some starts, but mm-hmm. you know, we always hear that he's right there and he's on the brink of being a fixture of this offensive line, and then he's never quite broken through. Mm-hmm. And I think he has, you know, we just heard it from Eric Mateos the other day, like he has the opportunity again. He hasn't fallen off. And so it sounds like he and Josh Braun are kind of they're kind of competing there at that spot. And so mm-hmm. I think, you know, Braun has gotten all the first team reps. What we see in practice isn't necessarily a depth chart, but it's a pretty good indicator. And so, you know, we keep seeing Josh Braun at that first team spot and Tykes at that second team spot. And so, you know, I think this will be an interesting year for him and see if he can break through. Harris, you know, he was a highly regarded high school prospect, right? Mm-hmm. I remember that from the last time I was on the beat in 2022. And so I just think, you know, Harris, we hadn't heard a lot about Harris, like when we were talking to coaches before we talked to Coach Mateos the other day. And somebody, I can't remember who asked the question, but somebody asked, they're like, we haven't heard much about Harris. Like, how is he doing? And mm-hmm. then actually the rest of the time we heard that he was doing really well. And then the next day he was with the first team offense at left guard. So, I mean, I think, you know, he has the chance. I think depending what happens with Kutis, if he's in and out, you know, this season, he's missed a lot of practice. We'll see if anybody else kind of goes down and they have to shuffle around. We will see what opportunities arise for those guys. But yeah, I mean, those two, especially those two that have been here for a while, but haven't really broken through. Mm-hmm. I feel like they could have the opportunity this year. It's just going to depend what happens with the rest of the personnel.
I think with Harris, his weight has been part of the problem, and not that he's too big, but that he had been too small. You hear Sam Pittman say this all the time, that it's a big man's league and you got to have big people up front in order to win, both on offense and on defense. And I think what happened with Marion, he came in real big, lost a lot of weight, and I think he kind of liked how he looked. And I think there was a little bit of a struggle probably, you know, to get that weight back up to what's got to be a playable weight. He was down, I think, in the 290s last spring. Wow. You can't play along the offensive line, you know, in the SEC at that weight. And so I think they've got his weight back up to where they want it now. And it'll be interesting to see if now that, you know, he looks, and I'm sure he feels, and he's probably got the, you know, the knowledge of what they want him to do. How does he put all that together? Yeah. And, know, with Kudus being out so long, I think it's a very good possibility that Harris could be a starter game one when they play UAPB in his hometown.
Yeah, it's possible. I didn't even think about, the hometown aspect. So, I mean, we'll see what happens with that. I think they're doing a lot of shuffling with that left guard spot. They put him in with the first team, and then they put Amari Wiggins back at second team center with Addison Nichols at first team center. And those two guys had kind of been rotating between center and left guard with the first team with Kudus out. And then they kind of brought Harris into the mix. So I'll be interested to see what they do. You know, Eric Mateos kind of, he said that if they were to play tomorrow, I believe he said it would be Amari Wiggins at center and Addison Nichols at guard.
Okay.
And so that was what he said, you know, earlier, or maybe it was late last week. And, you know, he said if we would play tomorrow, that's what we would do. And then, you know, now Harris is kind of more in the mix. So I think it'll be interesting to watch what happens at that left guard spot.
It's always changing. You never know. And, you know, we've talked about this with your offensive line. There are contingency plans all across the board. So if this guy goes down, we know it's going to be this five, and it could be, you know, taking somebody out of this position and moving them over. It's just all about how do you get your best five on the field together that are available to you. And so, you know, like you said, interesting. That's a good way to put it. I asked Ethan this question yesterday. We're about midway through preseason camp. In fact, we're probably a little over midway through. I think that, you know, what they consider camp ends early next week, maybe this weekend. And then they, you know, you've got a longer, quote, game week leading up to that first game. But, you know, let's just say we're halfway through, maybe a little over halfway. What are your mid-camp takeaways on this team?
Yeah, I mean, I know we just were talking about the offensive line, but I think one of the things I've noticed is we just keep hearing how much better, sort of, I guess for lack of a better term, the vibes are with the offensive line. And I never know how much to trust that. Because sometimes I feel like if you're talking about how great the vibes are, that maybe says that the on-field stuff isn't as great. And I don't know that that's always true. I don't know. So that's just kind of something that I'm watching, especially because of how poorly the offensive line performed last season. And this is a lot of different personnel, obviously a different coach. How different is it really going to be? And how different is this sort of culture change that they keep telling us about? How much is that really going to matter when they are on the field? So I think that's something that I've been trying to pay a lot of attention to, is the way that they're talking about it and the way that they have said, as far as a more on-field improvement, they have said that they feel like communication is a lot better. And we've heard that from other guys on the offense, not on the line. We've heard that from receivers, quarterbacks, et cetera, that their communication is a lot more effective. And so that's something that I feel like could actually come into play on the field. And so I'll be interested to see what happens there. I think I talked about this last time I was on the show, but the wide receivers, who is behind that first group and how well they can perform. So behind Tyrone Roden, Andrew Armstrong, and Isaiah Satania, that second group behind them, how well can those guys perform? What will their opportunities be? Will they make the most of them? I think that's been a big thing. And then defensively, they got a couple of, you know, spring transfers that I think are going to be really versatile for them. And they've got a linebacker and a DB that they've now flipped. You know, the linebacker is now playing DB and the DB is now playing linebacker. And both of those guys had done that at their previous schools. And so I think they've got some versatile pieces, especially in the backfield, that they can move around. And I think that's been something that's been pretty striking. So I think I'll be interested to see how they actually deploy those guys and what that does for their defense.
Good stuff. You can read all of Christina's reports, by the way, on wholehogsports.com. You can get the latest breaking news on our website. We think it's the most in-depth source on Arkansas sports, but we are a little biased. Analysis, recruiting, latest news with Richard Davenport. You heard him on our podcast yesterday. If you didn't catch that, go back and listen to that. He had some good thoughts about some recent football commits at Arkansas. Unique stories on all the teams on campus. Soccer starts this week. Anthony Christensen was on our show yesterday and gave us a little bit of a soccer breakdown for an Arkansas soccer team that's expected to be very good again this year. You can subscribe today at wholehogsports.com. We're going to have Cam Meller of the College Football Network on the show a little bit later, but when we come back, Christina and I are going to go a little bit more in depth into schedule strength. Arkansas is going to play seven teams in the AP Top 25, but I'll tell you why I don't think it's the hardest schedule in the country. That after a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King. We are Soapbox. We are ShopCart. We are design.
You can stay on top of all the Razorback sports with a digital subscription to the Hogs Illustrated app. You can see our latest Hogs Illustrated here on the desk. It was our Olympic preview. Of course, the Razorbacks had a great time over in Paris. They had several medalists, including some gold medalists over in Paris. Chris Bailey was a gold medalist. Kaylin Brown got a gold medal for her work with one of the relay teams. Amber Anning won a couple of medals for relay teams. Brown also got a silver medal for one of her relay teams. Great week for the Razorbacks in track and field. Bob Holt wrote a story yesterday on our website that said that if Team Arkansas, and this is all the athletes who compete for or have competed for the Razorbacks, or maybe the assistant coaches who are still in competition, or some of the pro athletes who just come here to Fayetteville and train, if Team Arkansas track was its own country, only Team USA would have won more medals over there. So you can see, obviously, Christina, you had great foresight to do an Olympic preview. And a lot of the stuff that you wrote about in there, you know, kind of came to fruition, the fact that they were so good. You can get the most complete Razorback coverage at Hogs Illustrated, 20 issues every year. Complete access to our website at wholehogsports.com. Monthly subscriptions begin at $17. You can join Hogs Illustrated at hogsillustrated.com/subscribe, or you can call 479-684-5509 to subscribe to Hogs Illustrated. We will get a new Hogs Illustrated on the desk here very soon. We are finishing up our new magazine. It's always tough in the summer, Christina, because this magazine is the one that stays on the newsstands the longest throughout the calendar year, just because there's not a lot going on.
Right. We get a little bit of a break, and then we launch into our weekly, you know, we're monthly all through the mm-hmm. spring, and then we launch into weekly for football season. So working on the pre-UAPB issue right now and finishing that one up.
Yeah, Arkansas and UAPB coming up. It'll be here before you know it. Okay, so UAPB, that doesn't factor into Arkansas' schedule strength at all. But the AP Top 25 poll came out yesterday, and we talked about the coaches' poll when it came out a week or so ago. But just wanted to mention this. Arkansas plays seven teams in the AP Top 25. They play Texas. They play Ole Miss. Texas is number 4. Ole Miss is number 6. Missouri is number 11. LSU is 13. Tennessee is 15. Oklahoma State is number 17. And Texas A&M is number 20. Only Florida plays more teams in the AP Top 25 this year, in the preseason AP Top 25. The Gators play 8 teams that are ranked. South Carolina also plays 7 teams, like Arkansas. Oklahoma plays 6 teams. Nobody else plays more than 5. So it's a tough schedule. We've come to expect that. You know, Arkansas, they get a little bit of bad luck, it feels like, with scheduling, because I always go back to Southern Cal many, many years ago. They scheduled Southern Cal, Christina, in like 2000 or 2001. And at that point, Southern Cal was not very good. I think they had come off a losing season. And then that offseason, they hire this guy named Pete Carroll. And then all of a sudden, Southern Cal becomes Southern Cal. And Arkansas doesn't get to see them till 2005 and 2006. And those games were really, really bad for the Razorbacks. You know, real huge blowout losses, both in L.A. and here in Fayetteville. Whether it be that, you know, they've caught Texas on some years where Texas was really, really good. They caught them on a year where they weren't very good a few years ago. But it just seems like, you know, whether it be USC or Oklahoma State this year, or, you know, I mean, there have been many instances of this. They just seem like they catch some bad breaks when it comes to these non-conference games that are scheduled so far down the line that you don't know what that team's going to look like in 11 or 12 years.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is how far in advance these games get scheduled, these non-conference games. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you might schedule a team. It could go the reverse, too. You might schedule a team that you think is going to boost your strength of schedule. You know, a team like Georgia is trying to, you know, is trying to build a strength of schedule to a certain extent. So them, for example, like, they might schedule a team 10 years out that they think is going to be good and it's going to add to their mm-hmm. strength of schedule. And then in a decade, that team has totally fallen off. And then all of a sudden, it's a cupcake game and it doesn't help you at all. So it's funny how that goes with non-conference.
And then there's also the flip side to it. You know, they scheduled Texas A&M to play them for 10 years in Arlington. And then after 3 years, Texas A&M became a conference game. So you just never know when you're scheduling these teams. But, you know, I've got a little calculation that I use. And basically, you add up the teams that are in the top 25. You take into consideration some things like where are the games played, what is the travel like, things like that. And putting that together, I've got Florida as the number one schedule by a long shot. And we'll talk about who they play here in just a minute. I've got South Carolina at number 2. I've got Oklahoma at number 3, even though they play one fewer top 25 team than Arkansas. And I've got Arkansas at number 4. It's a tough schedule, But when you kind of dig into it a little bit, these teams that they play in the top 25, there's a little bit of a silver lining, I feel like, for Arkansas. They play Texas at home. They play Ole Miss at home. They play LSU at home. They play Tennessee at home. That's four of their top five teams in the rankings. They play Texas A&M in Arlington, which, contrary to a widely held belief, that is a true neutral site game. Anybody who's been there knows that even though it's closer to College Station, whenever that game is played, it's usually very close to a 50-50 split. And there have been times where there have been more Arkansas fans there, because I feel like the Arkansas fan base has embraced that game more than the A&M, you know, people have. The A&M ADs for years and years have been, you know, very opposed to that. And I think that it is reflected in the stands there. So you play four home games, you play A&M on a true neutral site. They're not going to win all those games. I don't think anybody expects that. But maybe they pick off a couple of teams at home. I mean, they play Texas after a bye. They play LSU after a bye. Both of those games are in Fayetteville, and both of those teams have to play the week before. Pittman's teams, you know, say whatever you want to, but they've been very good after bye weeks. Look at what happened last year. They won their only SEC game against Florida after a bye week. So there is a little bit of a silver lining. I guess Mr. Brightside here says that, you know, hey, it's maybe not as bad as you think it is. And then Oklahoma State, I'm very interested in that game, even though it is over in Stillwater. I just don't know that Oklahoma State sees SEC teams. And say what you want about Arkansas, they do have a roster that I think, you know, can compete with the SEC, at least on the front line. And so early in the season, you know, maybe before the injuries start to take hold, you wonder, can Oklahoma State handle, you know, that type of physicality that Arkansas wants to bring? Now, can they bring it? We don't know, but that's the type of team that they want to have. And so, you know, we all think that September 7th is going to tell us a lot about this team.
One thing that struck me about Arkansas's schedule too, that I keep talking to people about, is the more winnable conference games, which I would say are Mississippi State and Auburn. I'm pretty low on Auburn. I think some people are higher on them than me, but I'm not high on Auburn. But I think those are two of their more winnable games, and those are on the road. Mm-hmm. And so they get, you know, Arkansas has a great home schedule for as far as like bringing good, you know, good opponents.
The teams
here
you want to see.
Exactly. So you like, there will be some exciting games. You'll get to watch some good teams. But some of the games that you would think, okay, Arkansas has a pretty good shot at winning this, and they wouldn't necessarily need, you know, you mentioned they have chances at upsets, mm-hmm. where you wouldn't necessarily call it as much of an upset, are on the road. Mm-hmm. And I want to say they're, I guess Auburn's early, but Mississippi State is a little later in the season,
in
you know. So it's just, I'll be curious how those games go. And I think that's a little bit of kind of the catch 22, I guess, is you have some of the, I guess, easier, for lack of a better term, games on your schedule, but you do have to go on the road for those. And your harder games are at home, which in theory should give you an advantage. But also, we talked before the show about Arkansas needs to win home games.
Yeah, and I've got some numbers here to back that up. You know, so since 2001, when the stadium underwent its first major renovation, there was another one in 2018 that closed the north end zone. But, you know, the one in 01 gave the stadium pretty much, you know, what we, the current look that it has. 73-52 overall. That's the home record. It's not a good home record. But then you dig even deeper into it, and it's real bad. 30-42 against SEC teams at home since 2001. That's 41, almost 42% winning percentage. That's bad. And then you're against Power 5 teams. So, you know, Texas Tech has come in and won. TCU has come in and won. And there have been others against Power 5 teams in Fayetteville, 32-48 since 2001. That's a winning percentage of 40. That's got to get better. I mean, if you're ever going to take a step as a program, you've got to win your home games. And I was thinking about, you know, what are the best sports on campus? You got baseball. You know, I'd say basketball is a pretty good team, pretty good program now at this point. Soccer is one of the great programs. What all of those teams have in common is they win their home games. I don't know that soccer has lost a regular season game in Fayetteville since like 2020. Or two, maybe 2021, they win almost every time they go out on that field. And it's become, you know, kind of this deal where I think, you know, teams, I don't know if they fear coming here, but I think maybe they have some doubt that they can win here once they get to Fayetteville. And they've beaten good teams. North Carolina came here and they lost at Razorback Field over that time. Baseball, they're always winning home games. I mean, look at the schedule they played last year, and they did very well against it. Teams like LSU and Florida, and Ole Miss was down, but, you know, you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's a good schedule. basketball, Bud Walton Arena, for years, even under Mike Anderson. They weren't a good road team, but you always knew they were going to be a really good home team. That's where football's got to get to. And I know it's more difficult in football because the SEC is the SEC, but how do you get to that point in football where you win, I don't know, maybe 70% of your games, as opposed to whatever this record is, 73-52 since 2001.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see a ranking of the SEC teams by their home win percentage over the last, you know, same amount of time, same time period, if you could compare them all and see.
I would venture to say most of them are a lot better.
Right, and I wonder, you know, where Arkansas ranks, what teams are near the top. Maybe some of them are surprises. You know, maybe there's a trend where some of the historically top programs in the SEC are at the top. Maybe some of them are not. You know, I'd be curious to compare across the conference.
All right, Georgia, I think they've lost one home game since 2019.
Yeah.
It was Pittman's last year as an assistant coach. They lost to South Carolina. They got upset there. It was a morning game. And since that point, I think they've only lost one home game.
Yeah.
Now that's Georgia. And I get
they haven't
totally
lost many games, period.
Right. They're in a totally different category.
Sure.
But you got to win your home games.
Right.
How can you ever expect to be a bowl team if you're constantly having a 1-3 or an 0-4 SEC record at home? That's got to get better.
Yeah.
I just don't think there's any two ways about it. And you can't even talk about Arkansas being a program on the upswing until they can start winning their home games. It's got to get better. This 30-42 against the SEC over 23 seasons, that's bad. That's real bad. And it's got to improve for the Razorbacks to be able to take that next step as a program. Cam Miller is from the College Football Network, and he'll be with us in just a moment after this word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King. We are Soapbox. We are ShopCart. We are design.
Final segment here on a Tuesday. We appreciate you being with us. Our show was brought to you in part by Bentonville Glass, serving its community since 1971. Committed, professional, versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass product needs with the highest quality products. You can see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. Cam Miller is with the College Football Network, and he joins us now. Cam, we appreciate you being here.
Happy to be here.
Hey.
Paul, it finally feels real, like we're around the corner.
Yeah, it does. You know, it's we're 16 days from the start of the college football season. Arkansas, one of many, many teams that play on that Thursday night. You know, one of the reasons I want to talk to you, Cam, is that you all do preseason All-America teams and some other different individual honors. And one thing that caught my eye here recently is that you had Anton Junkaj, Arkansas's defensive end, who's transferred in from the University of Albany. He was an FCS All-American last year. You've got some high praise for him. You've got him as your National Defensive Transfer of the Year.
Yeah, it's easy to look at when you look at the body of work that he was able to put forth at UAlbany. But also, if you look at how he was winning, how often he was winning, and what I think translates from that FCS level over to the FBS level, that the praise was easy. It's one of the fun projects we do over the offseason is look at every FCS to FBS transfer, sort of rank him internally for this purpose. But he was the top of the list of every one of our analysts and myself, just because of the skills that translate from one level to the other. Size to speed. If you look at it, he can win everywhere as well. So there's versatility, there's size, there's speed. Don't know if that speed correlates over as well as I think maybe every other attribute that he brings with him. So like to me, it was the strength that he's able to generate from every position across the front. So if you watched his tapes at UAlbany, he was winning, whether he was lined up Leo or right outside end, or if they shaded him off the center as well, and he was winning just the same. So to me, the strength that he presents and that versatility, that's arguably one of the things I think not just helps his game at the next level, but also helps Arkansas in general, because I think he can fit in a lot of roles.
I was talking to someone recently, and we were talking about him, and he had 15 sacks at Albany a year ago. And basically the comment was sacks are sacks. And, you know, it may not really matter the level. Now, I don't think anybody expects him to come in the SEC and get 15 sacks. But from what I'm hearing from you, it sounds like you think that could translate fairly well.
Yeah, it translates immediately as well. Go back to the season opener last year. That's the game that really caught my eye. It was that Fordham game for him specifically. Mm-hmm. Four sacks and a forced fumble. Obviously, that'll ping your interest. But if you watch how he won, it wasn't just those sacks either. There were times that he was causing havoc off the edge. He was forcing the quarterback off his mark and into the arms of other players, other defenders as well. And then he set the edge in the as well. So there's another stop he makes, a tackle for a loss in that game too. Both of those skills in both facets, pass rush and against the run, they'll translate over. I don't want to compare him. It's easy to do so with the Jared Verse because they're completely different players. Mm-hmm. Verse is a speed rusher going to FSU from UAlbany, whereas Junkunch is the opposite, a power rusher with some speed to his game. So it's a lot different, but that comparison's there in terms of how well they're prepared coming from UAlbany to the FBS level. And I think that him being in this fall camp in Arkansas, getting used to it as well, it's a great offensive line to go up against every day in practice for him to continue to acclimate. I think it does get he's ready right away, in my opinion.
We were talking on our show last week about FCS football and how I think it has gotten better because of some of the changes that have happened in college sports over the last few years, one of which is that college football and every sport has just gotten older. And so there are a lot of players who kind of get pushed out of maybe FBS, or maybe they don't find a home when they get into the transfer portal. And so they fall down to FCS. It feels like, you know, and we see this early in the season, maybe some more competitive FCS versus FBS games than we used to see. Is it a better product than it was maybe 5 years ago?
I'm probably the worst guy to ask that because I'll go down to D3 football, and even I love high school football in terms of the product that it offers. But to the question specifically, yes, and that's the exact reason. It's no longer go the JUCO route. These guys are understanding I can get drafted from FCS, and then they get there as well, and these staffs are so friendly. The communities have bought in. If you look at it, I was privy. My wife actually went to JMU before they were an FBS program, when they were still the FCS powerhouse that they were, and the community buy-in. I don't think that programs or fans realize this, but that buy-in keeps those players in town and keeps them from leaving. Couldn't say the same for JMU in terms of their head coaches and how fast they all left, but the players themselves stayed because they felt the love and admiration, and it felt like a big school program or a big school town. Harrisonburg, Virginia did, and I think that's a testament to that as well. It's the age, you're not finding your home, but also these schools are treating it like they are major college football programs.
Cam Miller of the College Football Network with us. Cam, in your preseason All-SEC, you had Isaiah Satania as a second-team receiver. You had Jalen Braxton as a second-team defensive back. I was kind of interested. You had Landon Jackson as a third-team defensive end. He's a little bit higher on some people's preseason radar, so to speak. Just kind of take us through those three players and what you see from them.
Yeah, I think the receiving core is underrated, I'd say. So if you stick with Satania there, and I'm still a Tyrone Broden believer. From back as his Mac days. So I do think that this is an underrated receiving core. I think you have a quarterback finally who has shown to be more than just a dual threat as well. No love lost for KJ Jefferson. I think he'll do good things down at UCF. But to me, Tanya as well, his ability to win, similar to Junkodge, who we're talking about, the versatility across the formations as well. I'll speak specifically to Landon Jackson. I had him higher, but I'm beholden to where my staff as well and my team of analysts all ranks everybody. And I think that speaks to the volume of how good the edge class is or the defensive line class is in the SEC this season, that he only made it to that honorable mention or third team, wherever he landed. I don't know off the top of my head specifically how many votes he got, but it speaks to how talented and how good these offensive lines are going to have to be in the SEC this year.
SEC media predicted Arkansas 14th out of the SEC. Only Mississippi State and Vanderbilt were behind them. What do you think the ceiling is for the Razorbacks?
The ceiling is to play spoiler at this point. I think there's a lot of unknown. I think Taylen Green brings a lot of unknown to defensive coordinators in the SEC that might not have been able to see him play, might not have, they have the tape, but maybe we don't know what we're going to get. I think Eric Mateos as well in the building presents an immediate surge in terms of the trenches where they can win. I think a 6-6 .500 record is probably a good bank if you get a couple of breaks to fall your way and a couple of those things, but I don't disagree. 14. I have him right now at 13, teetering between 13 and 12. But I think I'm a lot lower on Auburn than everybody else is in the SEC media. So, right on par with that. I could see a 6-6 record this season. Ceiling maybe a little bit higher. Winning record after a bowl game victory, perhaps.
Interesting you say Auburn, because we had Christina Long in here just a second ago, and she kind of said the same thing. She's not real high on Auburn this year. It's interesting when it comes to Auburn, because they came into Fayetteville and they laid the smack down last November. They could have won that game 65-3 if they wanted to. They called off the dogs after three quarters. So obviously it was a bad matchup for Arkansas last year for whatever reason. They play Auburn early in the season. What is it that where's the hesitance come from with Auburn?
I think it's what this offense presents, and I think it's what Peyton Thorne does at quarterback. There's far too many games and far too many inconsistent moments that Arkansas got the best Peyton Thorne possible, but I also think they got the wrinkles in the offense that have also had been figured out, maybe didn't quite get figured out in that game. To me, I think that's one of those Arkansas fell flat. Correct me if I'm wrong. That was right when the national media was calling for Sam Pittman, right at that point.
It was right after the game. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a lot of pressure, I think, just in general. I don't know what happened. It's hard to stay at the local level during the season, especially in November. But to me, no, that was the Auburn at its pinnacle. And I don't think that that's what we see week in and week out through this SEC schedule. And I'll put a lot of it on Peyton Thorne as the inconsistent quarterback and inconsistent ringleader.
Of course, Auburn, they went back to Auburn the next week and they lost by 3 touchdowns to New Mexico State, which kind of, you know, it illustrates the up and down nature of what that program was like last year. You know, one of the big games for Arkansas that a lot of people have circled early is Oklahoma State. They go to Stillwater in week two. It feels like that's the game where people feel like that's where you're going to see win or lose. Has Arkansas gotten more physical on the line? Do they have better athletes at some of the skill positions? I know you wrote something recently on Big 12 and schedule strength, so I know you've looked at Oklahoma State. What do you see from Oklahoma State, and how do you, you know, putting your future lens on here, what do you see from that matchup, Arkansas and OSU?
It's very similar teams, in my opinion, in how they like to win and how they like to get things done. I learned last year, I think I picked Oklahoma State to finish second to last in the Big 12. So I was very wrong, and I will never count out Coach Gundy again. That being said, I don't know if Alan Bowman is the guy that leads this team into the promised land. We saw them lose to South Alabama with the team, I think, that was just as talented. But I also don't think that they had figured out their identity during that South Alabama matchup last year. And Ollie Gordon is that dude that has them riding that new identity. And so to me, Ollie Gordon is the difference maker on pretty much every game on their schedule. If they have a chance to win, or if it's a couple of points here and there, I give the advantage to Ollie Gordon. You got to figure out how to stop him. And if Arkansas can do that, they have a real chance. I'd put that line, or I'd put the probability from our strength of schedule. I do have it up here. It's at a 40% chance from our numbers to win. So I think a lot closer than what people might be thinking that game might be if they're high on the Cowboys.
I have felt for a long time, and in Oklahoma State's not too far from here. It's about 3 hours from where we sit. And so it's a program that I pay attention to for a few reasons. But I have felt for a long time that when Texas and Oklahoma left the Big 12, that there weren't a whole lot of programs that stood more to benefit from that than Oklahoma State, because they've always been right there kind of in the upper tier of the Big 12. They haven't won a whole lot of Big 12 championships. They've won some, but you know, now that you've got the two, you know, big dogs out of the way, and I know you bring Utah in and you bring, you know, some other teams over the last couple of years have come in that have got good football programs too, but doesn't it feel to you like Oklahoma State could really benefit from this, especially as it relates to the expanded playoff, being in a Big 12 that's without Texas and OU have run that league?
Yeah, what's their bugaboo now? Who's their team that they have to really put their hats on and say, this is a team we need to beat? It's a West Virginia. It's a Texas Tech. It's this year. It's Arizona and Utah, as you said. I don't know if those teams are built for long-term success, like Coach Gundy has been able to build this Oklahoma State team. Utah notwithstanding, after they move away from Kyle Whittingham, I believe those two and Kirk Ferentz are the three longest tenured head coaches in our sport at this point. So there's a reason Gundy's been there for as long as he's been there. And I do think, yes, they're no longer little brother and not even little brother. They're the third born in the Big 12 rankings when Texas and Oklahoma were there. So I would absolutely put them up there as the team, you know, the pinnacle of success for not just a single season, but ultimately longevity in that Big 12. That's who these other teams look up to. It is probably theirs to lose more often than it's not.
How much have you looked into SEC schedule strength? I noticed you've got some other conferences ranked on your site.
Working on that. It's eye-opening to look and see a program like Oklahoma, and I think the rude awakening they're in for. And when you look at it as just the, not quite granular, but if you look at it from the overarching view, who has the toughest by just a computer calculation, and then Oklahoma's schedule stands out as one of the more difficult. And I don't know if their roster's baked to withstand that this year.
When you look at schedule strength, because we were talking about this in the last segment, you know, I feel like a lot of times we just focus on the names. We don't necessarily focus enough on where the games are played. So, for instance, Arkansas's got a very hard schedule, but they play four of these games in Fayetteville. They play one of them at a true neutral site in Arlington against Texas A&M. It's not, you know, they're still going to be very hard games, and nobody's going to expect Arkansas to win very many of those. But you I feel like, you know, home games are winnable. You're prone to an upset. When you are the home team. The A&M game in Arlington, it's been just an absolute toss-up for a decade. What do you look for when you're assigning schedule strength? Is it just the names, or do you look, you know, further into the numbers?
No, we went full on in the numbers, and we assigned it, I guess, not to give too much of a peek behind the curtain on our metrics, but a value per every home stadium. We almost went to the EA Sports College Football 25 rate and put them as the toughest places to play and put a value on them. Don't give too much value to it over the actual product on the field we get, but absolutely, like you said, I mean, if you've ever been to a game at Baton Rouge, you know how difficult it is for opposing teams to play there. I live in the shadow of Ohio Stadium here in Columbus, Ohio, and so I know how difficult it is for opponents to come here, not just the 3 hours of the game, the Friday that they're here in town, the heckling, whenever anybody sees them or their, I mean, it's a 2 day long experience for these programs when they go on the road. So yeah, We assigned a value essentially to all those games that were on away stadiums and obviously gave benefit to some of those bigger, more home field advantages. But absolutely every game, looking at that Arkansas schedule, I completely agree with you. It could have been a lot worse in terms of where they have to go and who they actually get this year at home.
They get a couple of these ranked teams after bye weeks too, which Sam Pittman's teams have been really good after they get a week off. Georgia is the top ranked team in the AP poll, Cam. But one thing that stands out to me about their schedule is they got to go to Texas, to Alabama, and to Ole Miss.
I think people are underrating the Rebels. Maybe not. I believe it's only the second time in history they're as high as they're ranked in the AP preseason poll. So I might have misspoken there. But I think that to me, it seems like a road apple for most people when they say that on the schedule this year. It's not. And I think that Georgia team, I don't see them not winning 10 games, but I absolutely see them struggling to get to a double digit win total this season, unless we're proven otherwise. And Kirby's proven that to us over the past few years. He can, I feel like the old adage of reload, not rebuild is way overused, but Kirby's just simply loading every single position too often now to discount him. But it'll be a lot more difficult this year for them than it has been the past three.
As it relates to schedule strength, thinking nationally, not just SEC, what teams, you know, near the top, and I guess this would mainly be SEC and Big Ten teams, maybe Notre Dame, but what teams near the top have got a favorable schedule that you think might help them on the road to the playoff?
So I mentioned them earlier, the Arizona Wildcats, their schedule this year, I think they're the dark horse to win the Big 12. It wouldn't surprise me if they're 12-0, 13-0 winning the Big 12 because of how their schedule aligns. Their toughest game, I believe, is Utah early. So worst case scenario, they're 11-1 going to that Big 12 title game. And then I think if you look at it from there, there's a few other teams that stick out. Arizona, Missouri's got a very good schedule as well, shaping up for them, how they could get out maybe 11-1, looking at even a 12-1 SEC runner-up. You're going to have them as the sixth or seventh seed at that point too. So Missouri and Arizona are the two that stand out to me with maybe possibly the easiest in terms of how actual stacked their conferences are.
That plays back into the Arkansas spoiler role, right? Arkansas plays Missouri at the end of the year, maybe a chance to spoil something special for the Tigers in that end of season game. Cam Meller of College Football Network. Cam, we appreciate you being on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Happy to do this and hoping for a great season for everybody coming up here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Cam. We appreciate your time. Cam Meller of the College Football Network. We appreciate you being here today. Go to WholeHogSports.com. We'll have a lot of coverage of Razorback football practice as it ends up today. Also, Razorback soccer poll will come out today. SEC poll, Anthony Christensen, plenty of insight there as the Razorbacks get ready to start their season, a top 16 team in the national poll. We'll be back with another podcast tomorrow. We expect to have Matt Brown from the Extra Points newsletter on with us to talk about some of the big things going on in college athletics. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.